exactly did the Buddha say about rites and rituals? The Buddha said, that's a stage of enlightenment that you do away with rites and rituals.
Well, the first stage of enlightenment, one of the things that you overcome is all belief in the efficacy or power of rites and rituals, which isn't to say that there's no place for rites and rituals, but it's rather that you shouldn't. You know, what the Buddha was trying to communicate is that when you become awakened, you realize that simply reciting words does nothing. If you actually recollect something, and if you use reciting the words as an aid to recollecting something, then the recollecting of something does do something. But words and actions, at that time, the primary religious practices were the Brahmin rituals, and there were very many of them, and they were very important. And all of the emphasis was on doing the ritual exactly correct. It didn't really matter what the Brahmin was thinking of or what his intentions were, if he thought the person who paid him all this money was a total jackass, but since he was paying enough money, he was going to do, you know. That didn't matter. That was quite acceptable, because all power was thought to be in the rites and rituals. And the Buddha was saying, no, 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 no. Those things have no power at all of their own. So there is a place for ritual activities as an aid to intentional mental processes. And the forms of Buddhism that follow most closely upon the Buddhist original teaching keep the rites and rituals to absolute minimum. As a matter of fact, this is of original Buddhism, this is the entire ritual. There was never anything more than taking precepts and taking refuge. That was all. And anything else was considered to be, you know, slipping into the trap of believing in the power of chanting mantras and performing various rituals. I think that there is a place for these very simple things, not for, you know, maybe not for really any of us in this room, but maybe. But I'm just saying in general, maybe not, but there are other people. For example, going for refuge, it's not very well understood, and it probably should almost always be explained. It should be explained over and over again what going for refuge means, because it is so simple, it's very easily misunderstood. But it's what sets secular meditation, meditation for the sake of becoming capable of being richer and being happier in a worldly way, apart from meditation for the purpose of achieving wisdom and enlightenment and permanent liberation from suffering. You know, and I don't need to go into an explanation for you again of what it means when you go for refuge to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, but if you just reflect on what you already know that means, going for refuge is saying, okay, there's a reason why I'm meditating. There's something that it leads to, and that's what I'm trying to do. I'm not just trying to become calmer and happier and more easygoing. And the same thing with the precepts. They are a means to an end. You know, it's not just that if I'm generous to other people, then I will create circumstances for me to be more happy and prosperous in my life. It's going beyond that simplistic, naive, very worldly view to give a basis to your practice that goes beyond that. So I think there is a place for refuge in precept. But I'm not terribly convinced there's a lot of place for that. There's a lot of value in rites and rituals beyond that, because it becomes so easy for people to get lost in it. But people do like chanting mantras, and you know, people like to get together and chant things, and it makes them feel good.
It's not just makes them feel good though. It's like it helps them get into a different consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I mean, that sounds kind of like it helps them enter a completely different awareness. Mm-hmm.
Which is part of feeling good, right?
I think the feeling good of chanting together is more of a social, family, bonding kind of thing. And I think what you're talking about is like a real deeper, you can access a deeper space within yourself that has nothing to do with sitting with other people.
Well, that's right. Good. If meditating with other people seems to be more powerful than meditating by yourself often. Mm-hmm. And chanting with other people does. But there's two different kinds of chanting. There's the, oh, let's chant because then we'll all feel good together and be happy afterwards. And then there's, well, let's chant to get into an altered state, and if you want to join me in that, it would probably work better with our joint consciousness and that separately. So what you're saying is absolutely true. But there are these two different ways that people use chanting. People don't chant as a way to get don't always chant as a way to get into an altered state of mind, so that they can use that altered state of mind to for a higher spiritual purpose. Often that's the end in itself. You know, it's like smoking marijuana. Let's get in this altered state of mind together, and then we'll laugh and have a good time. Be happy, right?
All in the intention.
Short period of time.
All in the intention.
It's all in the intention. That's right.
Yeah.
That's the way it is with all rites and rituals. It's all in the intention.
I was just thinking about churches and singing hymns.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that's the social kind of.
Well, singing.
Well, the hymns they've got a word. They've got words to them that are very, you know, they're worship kind of words.
Mm-hmm. And you can take them on two different levels. You mm-hmm. can take them on the level of really being into the worship and the meaning of the words, or this is something that you really enjoy doing and it's fun doing, and, you know, I'm not a Christian. A lot of things that Christians believe don't have any special significance to me personally. But nevertheless, I have as much fun as anybody else when a bunch of people start singing gospel songs and I know the words and I can sing along. Mm-hmm. It feels good. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun.
But I think in Lakra I had maybe something more specific you were leading towards with your question?
I think that I've been in this kind of back and forth thing, you know, about it, having just all my life seen something that I like about candles, you know, like having candles. There's something says something to yourself when you light candles in a place where you're going to be working in interiorly or you're getting out of your daily life. And I've done a lot of rituals in my life, and you know, everything you said, I agree with that. But I've been back and forth too from, you know, what we did at Diamond Mountain. It's always great, and everybody gets together and we do this, and they all sing these words. There's a certain feeling that comes in the air, just like you said. So I got used to this one over here, since I started doing this over here. And at first I didn't like it so much, but now I'm used to it. Now I think, you know, I kind of like doing it to be set the stage, so to speak, for here we are all together, and this is a special day that we've set aside. And you said, it's just like going to church, and somehow you feel, it always makes you feel good, feel, you know, purer, or more in tune with something besides just conversations and reading books and, you know, all that stuff. You're accessing a different part of your brain, probably, a different part of your consciousness that I really want to enlarge upon. And I think it sort of sets it up for meditation. But then in the books I'm reading on Mudra, they say, and this is for people that are pretty advanced, when you sit down, don't say, I'm meditating. Don't think, I'm going to meditate. You're just doing it all the time. So you don't set special things aside. You don't say, now I'm going to meditate. That's different from the rest of my life. So I'm kind of trying to bridge between these two things to the place where I'm not that advanced, but I'm able to be in meditation all the time, being able to be totally present all the time. But I can see that's a place to get to, and so maybe in between there, you know, something like this, you know, it's kind of maybe it's a help and maybe it isn't. You know, I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think it is a help. I think it's very important for things where, like what we're trying to do here. We have a group of people of all sorts of different backgrounds and different degrees and levels of personal commitment and understanding coming. It's very important. I think I agree with the Buddha that it's very easy to get lost in ritual. On the other hand, I also think that you do need something, and like I say, especially for a mixed group of people with different backgrounds, to help them to, at the stage they're at, make a distinction between their ordinary daily life and their activities and what they've come here to do. The whole idea of an Upasita day is that lay people set this day aside and make it different. And so doing some kind of ceremony to mark that. And that's all this is like a little, I don't know, it takes less than 10 minutes to do this. But it marks that, okay, now we're being in a different way. We're doing something different. This is not work day, this is Upasita day. The other side of that, though, is that you don't want to get stuck in there. Where you'd like to get to be is where every day is a Upasita day. You know? And like with the Mahamudra practice, it's not you're going to sit down and say, okay, now I'm going to meditate, but that all of the time you stay in that fully present awareness. And so there's these two sides to it, and they're both true, which is really, it's what I started out saying earlier, that I see that there's a place for this. I see that it's really important. And I do see that if you bring too much ritual and things like that into it, or if the ritual itself becomes too appealing and too attractive and too exciting, then you run the risk. And it is, it's just a risk. It's not something that makes it absolutely undesirable. You do run the risk of losing sight of what the purpose of it was in the first place. The problem is when you become attached, oh, I have to do this. The problem is when you become dependent. We really want to enter into these special states of consciousness at will, anytime, and to be able to remain in them under all kinds of circumstances. To be dependent upon lighting candles and chanting certain things and having an altar and stuff like this becomes an impediment to being able to enter into that, into the state of mind that you want or need to enter into under other circumstances, and creates a dependency that could potentially keep you from being there all the time. So it's the dependency part of it, and it's the attachment part of it, and it's the also, I guess maybe it's the same thing, but it's getting attached to the good feelings that kind of, and beginning to do it for its own sake. Because, yeah, I mean, even as simple as, oh, I feel good about myself today because I did my ritual today the way I'm supposed to. So therefore, you know, I give myself a gold star and feel good about it. I mean, that's not what it's about.
I just had this hysterical cartoon pass through my head while you were talking about lighting candles and ringing bells before I go on Facebook. You know, because I think that what you're just talking about right now is kind of what I'm actually really working on, which is being more an observer, being more in the moment, just watching, not reacting, or watching myself reacting, you know, whatever, so that I'm at attention, not in a soldiering kind of way, but in a living kind of way, so that everything that I'm doing before I start it, I want to pay attention to it, so that I'm as much there as I can be, whether it's peeling apples or taking a bath or scooping out the cat box, you know, just daily stuff. But coming together, to me, reinforces me during the week. You know? So, I don't know. It's important, but I can also live without it, because I have for the last month.
But it's rites and rituals and all of these ceremonial kinds of things. They're tools, mm-hmm. and they're useful and valuable tools. Mm-hmm. And so we don't want to lose our tools, mm-hmm. but we want to use them intentionally, purposefully, knowing why we're using them, knowing that we're using them in the proper way.
And so then meditation is a tool as well.
Exactly.
And that's what we get. So that's when you know, Mahamudra Mudra says, you know, you're not sitting down to meditate. I mean, it's like you, it's pulling away that reliance on the tool of the meditation. Is that to just go with what is?
That's right. To practice Mahamudra, first a person will have gone through a period of developing strong samatha, because they need to. So they will have already made use of the tool of setting aside times and focusing all of their attention and energy on behaving and being and thinking in a particular way. Mahamudra is saying, okay, you've done all that work. You're all ready. Now it's time to let go of that dependence and let go of that limitation, because it limits you. Okay, now I'm meditating, and bing, okay, now I'm not meditating, back to normal. You know?
It's very subtle stuff.
Yeah. But that's just right for an advanced practitioner, and it's fine for somebody, you know, like we started out, it's fine for somebody like ourselves, we're committed to practice, we know what we're doing. We can intentionally and purposefully say, well, we're going to do the refuges and precepts as a tool, because today they'll be helpful. But we can equally well say, well, we don't really need to do those today. So we can let that go. It's not necessary. And that's the really good place to be. That's the right place to be. And that's sort of where I feel like I'm coming from. When people come here on Sunday, I want to do something intentionally and purposely, and hopefully encourage them to do it in the same way, to help them to make this tool available to them, to recognize that, okay, we're doing something differently than what we were doing an hour ago. And so when I'm doing if I choose to do the refuges and precepts, I've chosen it partly for that purpose. But since I'm going to do it, I'm not going to sit here and think about something else and mouth the words, you know, mentally. I'm going to take the opportunity to remind myself of what the meaning of the words are. So that whatever you've decided to do purposely for one reason, you continue to do in a fully present, purposeful, and meaningful way.
So, thank you, John. That was so well spoken and thought out. I really thank you. Because, as you said, when people come here, some of them don't have anything that they do, some of them have other things that they do. So this simple thing here, and I think also that the precepts are important, because there's so much depth in those precepts that we talked about from time to time, and I think it's still important. You know, you can go through, oh yeah, well, I don't kill, I don't steal, I don't, you know, I'm generous, you can sort of go through that way in your mind, but if you begin to think about your little daily thoughts and actions and words and everything in relation to those precepts, it's very rich, full, and that's really good to discuss from time to time, and also the refuge part, because when I first took refuge and started taking refuge, I said, what am I taking refuge? I mean, Buddha isn't anything to me. I mean, am I taking refuge in the Buddha? I'm taking refuge in the Dharma, the Sangha. You know, I couldn't get it. I thought, what am I, you know, I'm doing this, but why, what am I doing? And it took me a long time to really understand what that was about. And seeing what a refuge it was when I needed it. Because
that's right. These things, as simple as they are, I mean, these beginner things, they stay important. I mean, practicing the precepts, when you're a fully enlightened Buddha, I guess you don't need to practice precepts anymore. But right up until that moment, you do. They remain relevant.
Well, they're just part of your being.
There's no point where you say, well, I don't tell lies anymore, therefore I don't have to worry about that precept. No, it's like, okay, I don't tell lies like I used to anymore. Time for me to take it to the next level. What's the deeper level of meaning that comes after you stop telling those obvious lies? Okay. I don't engage in divisive speech like I used to. But to what extent is speech and thought still divisive in some way or another? There's always more to be learned and practiced and discovered.
There's no end.
Well, I think, you know, there may be an end in the complete and total enlightenment of the Buddha. Uh-huh. But there's no end short of that, for sure.
Yeah.
The other thing, too, is that I just mentioned is that there's a flip side to being attached to rites and rituals. On the one hand, you can become attached to them, you can become dependent upon them, and you can use them as an inappropriate, use them inappropriately just as a way to get high, feel good, have a good time. There's a flip side to that too. The opposite of attachment is aversion, which means that you can experience dislike for rituals, or disapproval, or disdain, or conceit, or, you know, there's all kinds of other things. And I've been through that.
Me too.
I've been through looking at and listening to people's rites and rituals and saying, oh, what a silly, nonsensical waste of time. What's the matter with these people? Just grow up and get beyond that. And not that there wasn't an element of truth in what I was thinking, because there was, you know. But the thing is that by holding those attitudes, you know, what I come to realize is, oh, okay, I guess I've got some more things to work on here myself. This is a form of attachment too. So the only thing, when you see somebody else misusing rites and rituals, if you experience aversion or disdain, then you've got more work to do on yourself. The only wholesome thing that comes out of recognizing that somebody else is misusing rites and rituals is to ask yourself, is there some skillful means by which I could help direct them to a more wholesome use of these? And the answer may be yes and maybe no. But whether it's yes or no, I mean, if it's yes, you do something about it. If it's no, you just accept that without, you know, without worrying in your own wisdom. And looking down on them for their ignorance.
They do provide refuge to different people in different ways. Superstition level or whatever, if people are in great agony and mental confusion and distress, mm-hmm. sometimes, you know, being able to pray to the Virgin Guadalupe or, you know, lighting candles for somebody's illness or whatever things they do, even like Christine sent me this picture of Amici because of my accident. Well, I would never think of doing anything like that, but I put that picture up there, and she had such an expression of peace and love on her face that it just kind of radiated out into the room, and I thought, well, why not? You know, I mean, see this beautiful being that's not, it's just my projection, but nevertheless, it was a nice feeling. Mm-hmm. I was surprised because when you told me she sent me a picture of Amici, I thought, well, I'm doing with a picture of Amici. But when I saw it and saw her face, I thought, well, I might look like that. Mm-hmm.
You do look more like that now. You do.
But you know, something about what I know, Amici, I've been in her arms before, and having a photograph of her to remind you of that sense of loving yourself, you know, that's not a ritual, but in a way it is.
In a way,
you know,
it is.
Because what we're talking about is how we can get to that central part of ourself that is okay.
To take, for example, somebody who every morning they get up and they ritually set up their altar, they fill all the little bowls and they clean everything up and they feel really good about it. There's nothing wrong with somebody making themselves feel good. I mean, it may be true that as we recognize that that has a very limited power, and there are much more effective things that can be done than these kind of daily rituals. But that does not mean that there's something wrong with somebody doing these things in order to make themselves feel better, at least for a little while.
But if they do that with complete awareness every day, that it's not just feel better. I mean, they could actually reach enlightenment through that practice.
Yes. But the limited power of it that we speak of is that usually, without a whole lot of other things going on in their life, that won't happen. What will happen is it will become more and more of a mindless ritual, and after a while it will stop making them feel so good, and after a while they'll think, why am I doing this?
But the possibility exists.
But the possibility
that
exists.
That if they do it with full awareness, mm-hmm. and, you know, with
yes.
heart of love for what they're doing, there could be a profound awakening in right. that action.
Although, it's, you know, I must admit, okay, I am very willing, anything from any of these traditions that I have experienced myself that is asserted can happen, I remain open to that possibility. Based on everything I know, everything I've done and experienced in my life, it's very hard for me to imagine that doing that kind of ritual on a daily basis is ever going to have that effect. But I hold open the possibility that it can. I don't see how, without wisdom, you can ever become free from suffering. And I don't see how wisdom can ever be attained without all of the other ingredients. You have to change the way, you have to become fully mindful, you have to change the way you behave and interact with people, and you have to learn how to use your mind in a way that allows you to penetrate beyond appearances and see things as they really are. So I don't rule out the possibility that somebody, by doing rituals alone, might somehow
right.
achieve awakening.
But, like,
but I just personally, I don't know how that would work.
I mean, Annie, you know, wants to be mindful, you know, changing the kitty litter box. And it's like, you know, be completely present. But what is she being completely present to? The smell of the kitty litter? I mean, we're being present to our reactions, you know. Is this aversion? I mean, I'm desiring to have this kitty litter smell out of here, or, you know, I'm in aversion. You're being mindful to the states of the things that we talk about all the time. I mean, the mindfulness isn't just, you know, here I am feeling the water on my hands. It's like, it's more than that.
If you're paying attention, we'll use the kitty litter thing. Because I had a really interesting thing happen, and just like approaching it and going like, I'm going to really pay attention to what I'm doing here. You know, like I'm doing all these little experiments, right, to see how aware I am. And so what happened for me this one time that I was doing it, I noticed that both cats were in the room and they were watching me. You know, it's like, and so it had a lot more meaning than just me. It brought in everything around me, not just what was inside of me, because I could see that I wasn't the only
one
that was changing the litter.
Yeah.
You know?
So your reaction to the kitty litter, it's like, you know, changing a baby's diaper. I mean, if you go, ah! I mean, how does that baby feel?
Yeah.
That was like, you know, a very important. You know, those poor cats. But it's like, it's also for you going, watching yourself go, and it's like, oh, there's desire and aversion.
Hmm. You know, and what you said before about looking at yourself scientifically and not really knowing whether or not is that OCD or is that, you know, what's going on here? I think sometimes that using the idea of ritual, is it coming from the outside or the inside? Is it something that we're creating in that moment, or is it something that's always been there dormant that the ritual might wake up?
Well,
you know, so
yes.
I think
the whole idea of the ritual is to reveal the inner Buddha nature, That's what you're pointing out to here.
And that's what I see often. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's familiar. I know that. You know, that's.
But the Kiti Litter Sadhana is a good example of what I'm saying. And you're you're absolutely right, but you're not saying something different than I am. You see, if somebody's spiritual practice consisted entirely of the kitty litter ritual, I mean, there's only, unless you've got 150 cats, there's only so much time you can spend cleaning kitty litter. And so, if all you do is the kitty litter ritual at these certain times that you do it, and if as deep as you get into it is ever smelling the kitty litter and feeling the feeling on your hands and noticing the aversion that you feel and things like that, that's hard for me how to see you'll ever become enlightened. On the other hand, if, as I know Annie does, you're also studying in different ways, listening, reading, attending things, and reflecting, thinking about this, thinking about how it relates not just to your kitty litter changing, but to everything in your life all of the time. Mm-hmm. And also cultivating a mind that is focused and aware, not only when you're changing kitty litter, but all the rest of the time. And so that when you're changing kitty litter, the awareness just keeps expanding and getting deeper, so that you go way beyond how it smells and how it feels and what your emotional reaction is. That's what I mean. I you know, it's hard for me to see how a ritual by itself, until it begins to entail all of these other ingredients, that you know, it's going to lead you there. So that's why I would encourage anybody, if you believe that the careful and mindful performance of a ritual over and over again every day is going to bring you to enlightenment, you know, that by itself, I caution them that, you know, it might not work.
So what do you think about spontaneous happenings? Whatever that means to you.
What are spontaneous happenings?
Little rituals that you just make up on the spot.
Is that what you mean, or do you mean?
Well, all of a sudden you have like this,
epiphanies,
Yeah.
Well, that's
awareness.
That's what I think, right? That's what we want to have. We go around, you know, most human beings, most of their lives, even with their eyes open and their mouths open, are asleep. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're looking for, is those moments that we wake up. And we want more and more of those moments that we wake up. And we want to carry what we realized when we woke up. We want not to lose that again when we go back to sleep.
But if we wake up doing something in a ritual way...
that's fine. That is absolutely fine.
Or you know, a trigger. I mean, I keep on finding myself in kitchens cleaning up.
Yeah, that's right.
I do. I'm like, oh, here I am in Alberta, you know, picking up all the wine glasses and all the beer bottles in the morning while everybody's
asleep. It's Alberta
asleep.
For you. Glasses and beer bottles.
And I'm like, and I'm doing it because I really feel bad because my sister-in-law, you know, I'm looking at, you know, it's like, this is her house and she doesn't, you know, it's not her scene. You know, and then I wake up and I go, oh, here you are, picking up the wine bottles and the beer bottles, and here you are, cleaning up as your service to whatever. And it's like, and I feel like, should I be doing this or not? This is what I'm doing. And it's like, you know, just do it with awareness. Like,
exactly.
And it's like, and yet I'm always in somebody's kitchen cleaning up. And, you know, yesterday I was in my kitchen cleaning up. Like, major. So,
yes.
And I'm like, okay, so for some reason, you know, I'm always cleaning. It's just, then I, it's like, oh, here I am again.
So and it's like, be with what we're doing.
And it's like,
that's right.
It's actually sort of hilarious.
That's right. Well, a ritual is an artificially contrived situation that helps us to practice being aware so that we can be aware all of the time. I mean, let your whole life become that way rather than that say, okay, the only way I can do this is turn the light down, light the candles, ring the bell, chant a little while, then I can do this. You know, it's got to be, it's got to be where you can do it while you're driving, you can do it while you're shopping, you can do it while you're cleaning up other people's mess.
Well, in the book that I was just reading, he said, you know, you can't try to do any of this.
Because there's no you to do the trying.
Yeah, and I think about that. All in.
But also, there's nothing wrong with people chanting to make themselves feel good and feel happy. You know, I wasn't saying that earlier either. It's just that if that's all you do, and if that's as far as you go, it has a limited power to temporarily make you feel good and feel happy. But I'm saying we should aspire to more than that. There's nothing wrong with that. There's absolutely nothing wrong with people doing things. As long as it doesn't harm somebody else, there's nothing wrong with anybody doing something that makes them feel better. Well, doesn't harm anybody else and doesn't harm themselves. If what you're doing to make yourself feel better and feel happy isn't harming anyone, there's nothing wrong with it. But believing that the solution to the problems of life is to do things to make yourself feel better, that is doomed to failure. That will never work.
But I don't believe that people chant just to make themselves feel better and happy. And I feel like when you say that, it sounds like it's just...
Some people do. A lot of people do. They chant. Am I not right? A lot of people do this. They chant because it makes them feel better.
I think they chant because it has more...
You think all of them?
I'm not trying to discuss what other people do or don't do.
We're discussing the range of practices that people engage in. You know, and so you have to recognize that there are a lot of people who use these practices, even meditation, they use as a practice to achieve temporary satisfaction. And you know, and like I said, there is nothing wrong with anything you do that's not harmful to achieve temporary satisfaction. It's just that that satisfaction is temporary. It is going to become, over time, more and more difficult to attain using those particular means. And it is that there are better things to do. There are better ways to go.
See, Nancy and I think that you can have outstanding experience that has a much deeper effect on you than just happiness.
Do you think I don't believe that?
No.
I don't think you're stating it in that way. If you're chanting and you believe that that's the mystic law of the universe that you're chanting, then it becomes the mystic law of the universe for you, and you also experience something by chanting the mystic law of the universe.
What if you're not believing that it's the mystic law of the universe? I mean, the Soka Gakkai people chant believing that it is the mystic law of the universe, and that's fine. What about the other people who don't have any belief like that? They just know that, hey, I like this, we all get together on Tuesday night, and we chant, and boy, do we ever have a good time.
But that's not what we're talking
about. That's what I'm talking about.
Not what
about.
Annie and I are talking about.
Well, no. Stick with the topic then.
That was perfect.
Stay with the topic. There are all of these different ways that people use these different things, and I'm saying they cover a range. And that There's nothing wrong with people doing them to make themselves feel better. But if you, rather than get into a place of judgment about somebody doing something some way, you see if you can move them along that ring. If there's people that get together to chant because it makes them feel better, and you can help them to chant because they believe that that it's the mystic law of the universe.
Well, they think it's the mystic law of the universe and it's going to make you feel better, is what they think. Or another person. They're not chanting for themselves. They're chanting for another person.
That gets even better.
So that's
chanting for the universe.
Well, they're chanting for, you know, other people or for, you know, they're not chanting for themselves. So that's even better.
Well, there's certain syllables, certain, like, om, certain other syllables that seem to have a vibrational power that when people do that, at least I've heard it enough times that I think I probably believe that om has a big effect, as if that vibration goes out, even in your own, for your own body, as you're doing it, it has an effect on your body and it has an effect on everybody who hears it, and that it probably carries out, as we've talked, every thought, action, and feeling has an effect on everything else in our connectedness. So there's that part of it too, and I think some of the chanting has to do with setting up these vibrational fields that have an effect on the whole. I'm pretty much having the experience of being with a group of people where we're doing that, of feeling a vibrational connection that wasn't there before, you know, like a really harmony of a feeling of we are all one, you know, an experience of harmony, and it seems like it eliminates some of the, in people's minds, their aversions and their judgments and everything else kind of go away with this continual. Even if it's not for a very long period of time, it seems like it bonds people in a group. That's my experience. So, and different kinds of singing. You know, singing, I think singing is great for the body. I should say gospel music. I mean, really get into it. They feel the spirit. They get the Shakti going through their bodies. And, speaking in tongues and all kinds of things like that. You know, these are all kind of mysterious things to me, but they do seem to happen.
Well, it's exactly the same thing as Nancy's saying. Somebody chants Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, and they believe that this is the divine law of the universe. What's important is that they believe that. Uh-huh. And where you begin to be in error is if you think there is something special about om, or something special about Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, or anything else. It's when you start imputing some kind of power to the rite or the ritual or some component of it, then you are falling away from the higher understanding that we're trying to recognize, that all of these things are empty. Meaning, by saying they're empty, we're meaning that they are not the way they appear to our minds to be.
Right.
Right?
But they are something.
They're not nothing.
Okay, so if they're not nothing,
they're not nothing. No, that's not, that doesn't follow. That's the conceptual mind that says, if it's not nothing, it must be something. Because if you accept that it's something, and this is what the whole thing is, you know, as Huineng says, ultimately, there is, ultimately there is no thing. There, you know, any kind of something, thing, thingness, this is a projection of the mind.
Nothing that has any physical.
Don't you think that that there's a trap in, oh, I think the direction, I'm getting a different direction and I'm seeing that there's, that's not my belief about my belief, that I make the sound and send it out to everyone. I feel like what I'm doing is joining the sound of the universe.
Yeah.
I'm just coming together with something. That if I get into thinking that I'm going to be sending something out, whoa, I better, you know. It's so easy to fall into believing that, oh, I'm doing that, you know. So that's what, when you were talking about that, that's what came up for me and what I have to be careful of when I'm seeing a belief that feels comfortable to me.
Yeah.
It's like, wait a minute. Like, that's not mine.
Yeah,
you are
absolutely right. We're falling into the trap of self and other and then ascribing to our... I mean, we can ascribe power to various elements of the other, like the ritual or the om, or we can ascribe the power to ourself. But the self is as much an illusion as any of those things. And the power does not belong to the self any more than it belongs to those things.
But I see that I do that anyway, regardless of how I perceive it in the bigger picture. So it's all about going back to the thing that we've been talking about, is being aware in the moment of what we're doing. Right? I just think that what I'm doing right now trying to be more observant, that I'm seeing more of what I'm joining with that isn't, if that makes sense.
So then who's the I? We all get into that.
Yeah.
And it seems like we have to operate on some kind of a level and be aware, you know, I'm always too. Where's the I? I mean, your body processes, you're just these emotions, you're all this stuff, you're not, there's no I. Okay, but then I'm acting like I'm I right now, or right, most of the time. And it's a dilemma, you know. It's a dilemma for as long as we're experiencing being the self. You know, let's just go unconscious. That's the only answer.
Well,
just lose your consciousness. Stop thinking. Stop feeling. Stop.
Well, but stopping thinking and stopping feeling and losing consciousness are not the same thing.
That's pretty much the no-self experience that
Bernadette
was talking about.
I don't think she spoke of it as losing consciousness. She spoke of it as actually doing things in the world. And
well,
there being,
she came
and there
back
being
to
nothing
that.
But consciousness.
Yeah, but she came back to that. Before that, she lost herself. She not lost herself, and when she became aware that she had no self.
So long as we're perceiving things dualistically, and so then what we need to do is to skillfully guide our dualistic perception. So if we find that we're imputing more reality than is avoidable to things, and more power and importance and value to ourself, than is avoidable, then what's skillful is to correct that. But we always have to go from where we are. You know, we have to be, you know, and so chanting syllables or mantras or names of sutras that we believe is powerful and produces some good effect up to a certain point is skillful, and beyond a certain point it stops being skillful. If we chant mantras for the sake of the good of the world, because we can't help believing that I am a self and you are a self and there is this world out there that's suffering, so let's us two selves get together, and because this mantra has this mysterious power in it, we'll invoke its power to make things better out there. You know, if that's where we're at, then that's where we're at. But there comes a point when you can let go of that too, and go beyond it.
Well, that's all those other selves. That's all your other selves that you're chanting for.
All your other selves,
yeah. All your other selves that are drowning in Pat's bed.
That's right.
Doing whatever they're doing out there that we've created with our minds to see that, then we have some need or some responsibility for caring for all these other selves of ourselves, right?
That's right. And there's two ways we can overcome this dualistic perception that we have. It's dualistic because we've divided into self and other. One is to expand the self to include more and more and more. And the other is to shrink the self so that we diminish its importance and its centrality. And we can actually do both at once. We can shrink the importance, the perceived importance of the self that we feel like we are, while at the same time expanding our sense of self to include all these other beings. The end result either way, if you expand the self to include everything, or if you shrink the self to nothing at all, the end result is a reality that's no longer divided into self and other. So, in a sense, you were talking about Bernadette Roberts. In a sense, what she's describing is the way that both things happen. The self shrinks to nothing. And then that's a temporary experience. But it allows you to engage much more fully in the process of eliminating the boundary and making the self include everything.
Yeah, you almost have to do the shrinking first.
I think that is... I'm not convinced that you have to, but I think it's definitely the most common thing that happens. I think people, through their meditation, through their practice, whatever their practices are, they come to that experience where the mind ceases to fabricate the self and there is no self. And there's not unconsciousness, there's just pure consciousness. And then afterwards, they still, you know, they come back into perceiving things the way they have before, but with this totally changed perspective. But there's still, at this point, a lot of work to do. Now they have to sort of go the other way. They have to... because after all, you can't live your life if you're, you know, there's a certain point in time you have this experience. You can't live your life or basically end your life in some moment of pure conscious awareness. What's that?
As long as you're in your body,
As long as you're in your body,
if
yes.
If you're in your body, then you take need to part of what's around you.
Right. But the difference is...
But with a different mental attitude.
That's right. Different. The difference is that now you have this totally different mental attitude. Now you know the way things really are. Now you just need to change the way your mind works. To keep reminding yourself, deepening your understanding.
And then you can be of some service.
That's right. Then you're able to be a bodhisattva in the world.